Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143.
And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com.
From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project is underway, and we're going to have a great show here today. Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is here. Rosemary Armeo, Northern investigative journalist, is back from Egypt.
A brief trip to Egypt.
Wow,
amazing.
Boy,
Tahrir
hell
Square.
Going on over there.
Yeah, I was in Tahrir Square.
Wow.
Very interesting place.
Fabulous. And you can check that blog on timesunion.com, of course.
Oh, that was a commercial.
Right.
Clever. Yeah. Slipped that in.
Very good. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. We start this program, by the way, by paying tribute to a guy who has shared this microphone with us, Don Decker. Don Decker, noted Capital Region broadcast journalist who died recently at the age of 79. Don has been a participant in this program in the past as a one of the substitute hosts, and really was a guy who made a big difference. He was a former news director of this station. Isn't that right, Alan?
He was. He hired me at Channel 6. He gave me my chance in television, and then I did it for a lot of years under him. And he was a guy with tremendous ethical chops. He was great. And he had a sense of humor. He put my twin brother, Lewis, and me on the television one night when each of us said, I'm Dr. Shartok. It was pretty funny. and he interviewed my boy, Jonas, when he was 12 years old with a Red Sox uniform because he was a crazy Red Sox guy during one of the hyped up things. But he took no prisoners when it came to doing right. And he was of the old school, of the best of the old school, that really, if something happened at your facility and you didn't want to cover it that big, he would insist on it. He would insist that they do for the people in their own organization what they would have done to anybody on the outside.
Ah,
you know, and he was really...
Cover yourself,
He was really quite...
One of the anecdotes I loved about it is his daughter reported that he would come home for dinner just before the news was about to begin, and the family would sit around the dinner table silently watching the local newscast. After the local newscast was off, they had finished eating dinner, and then they could talk. But there was no conversation around the Decker dinner table.
But I'm about to give you a little bit onto that. Not only would they talk, but they would talk to each other because he would be on the phone reaming somebody out for something, that he had said. And I mean, everybody got it, and you got it all the time. He would take copious notes, and he was just really, he worked at it. It was his whole life. And of course, his family, who he loved.
It's a great thing. Anyway, Don Decker. So the big talk of the past week was the amazing cover of the New York Post showing a man about to die on a subway platform. A man was pushed off the platform onto the tracks, and what you have is a freelance photographer who regularly was on assignment for the New York Post who snapped pictures of the man about to die. A couple of questions arise.
Yeah.
Is it appropriate for the Post to publish that photograph on the front page? And second, was the photographer doing the right thing by taking pictures? Discuss, class.
Yes, I love looking at Rosemary's face because she's about to tell us what's right here.
Well, I can tell you what I think. We certainly have been talking about it in the journalism school. It's been written about everywhere. And I have to say, I think the photo is amazing. And that's what a news photo is, powerful and about life and death. And that guy captured it, and it's a fabulous photo. It's like Kevin Carter's picture of the little girl in Sudan dying with the vulture behind her. And he ran into the same sort of criticism. I totally think he should have taken it. I totally think the Post should have run it. I think this whole lie that's coming out later, this completely incredible story that he wasn't really taking pictures, he was flashing the camera to kind of warn the conductor. I think that's completely bogus, probably made up by the Post. I want to know how much money he got for it, because making money on that seems horrible to me. And I noticed that the photographer has written a piece kind mm-hmm. of defending himself and doesn't mention money at all. So I find all of that just horrible. If I were he, I think I would have said, I took the photo. I wish I could have saved him. Have you ever been in a situation where it requires you to do something heroic and quickly? I freeze in those conditions. Mm-hmm. And I bet this guy did too. Snapping a picture is a whole lot easier than rushing towards a man hanging over the edge of the platform with the train coming and trying to pull him up.
And he wasn't the only one who was on the platform, right?
Correct.
No,
yeah.
In fact, the photograph shows people standing nearby, nearer than this fellow who fell over the edge, who might have reached down to help him.
A couple of things. One, it was his 15 minutes. He was on every morning talk show. Every morning talk show, he was interviewed at great length. And he, you know, he said things like he had so much equipment on him that he couldn't have moved and all the rest, as I remember the story. But also, it was disgusting. In other words, Rosemary, you may be right, but that doesn't mean any of us, certainly not me, have to like it. From a journalism perspective, you're right. But who really likes the idea of somebody taking a picture and capitalizing on somebody who has been pushed off the side? And by the way, I think the Post has been playing some makeup ball since that time, putting pictures of the alleged perp and the perp's background and all the rest all over the paper.
I didn't like it. Yeah, I don't quite understand what's the newsworthiness of it. I'm not sure, Rosemary, that I agree with you that it's a newsworthy photograph. It's one person dying and not a typical event. You know, the photo that you're speaking of during the famine of the young girl with the buzzard behind her, this was depicting something that was an ongoing problem that the world needed to deal with. What is the relevant issue at hand?
That's not
here?
True. This is a usual thing that it's okay to show gory, death-like pictures of foreigners, but not of people.
No, it's not foreigners. It's what's the social ill.
It's the people,
I like it when you guys start to fight.
People being pushed over this platform in the subway and violence in the subways has been a point of news for years, and in fact even was an episode on television on one of the cop shows. It's such an iconic thing. It's so frighteningly horrible that yes, it is definitely news.
Well, but also it serves a purpose, because there have been pictures since that time of everybody standing very close to the far wall and not next to the and I, by the way, I've always done this. I actually had a cousin-in-law who was pushed over the side and who broke,
horrible.
And he was a senior executive at NBC, a wonderful man, now gone, but he survived that, but he had a lot of broken bones. And the first jury acquitted the woman. It was a mistrial because one juror accepted her argument that God told her to do it.
Oh, boy.
To push him over. You know, it's scary down there.
There was a story a year ago, do you remember, Rex, where a man, it was the opposite story. Someone had fallen onto the tracks.
Oh, yeah.
And a man left his child. It was an amazing thing. Leapt down, grabbed him, and got him up, saved his life. And I remember, he was on all the talk shows also.
Sure.
It was remarkable. And I remember thinking that I could never have done that. I wish that I could. You want to think of yourself as doing that. But what he did was amazing. That was news. And this is true. This is more like how we react to death than horror.
You know, Americans have such a limited tolerance for it. You know, I've gotten some criticism over the past few days because we published, as did the other newspapers in town, the photograph of the automobile that was destroyed when the teenagers from Shenandoah and Shaker High School were killed on the Northway. For those listening from out of town, there was a terrible crash 10:20 p.m. one Friday evening after a basketball game. Four teenagers in a car were rear-ended by an apparently drunk driver, and two of the four were killed, the other two seriously injured. We did use a photograph of the SUV they were driving and got some criticism that it was insensitive, inappropriate for us to show that. It seems to me it was not. I mean, it wasn't the only photograph we showed. It was in the context, but Americans have a very limited appetite for anything that has violence or gore associated with
it. So, see, I'm not sure you're right. I think they have a tremendous appetite for it. I just think that there are some people who are offended by it. And, you know, I mean, I was offended by this New York Post thing. But of course, I'd be offended by anything in the Post. So, but I was offended by
There's definitely something terrible. Smarmy about the Post. And I tell you, I think this story later about he was really heroically trying to rescue the guy. It's an amazing photo of a horrible event. And what's distasteful and offensive is that this could happen, not that someone took a picture of it.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. Very interesting. By the way, while we're talking about a Rupert Murdoch enterprise, the New York Post, we should speak of another Murdoch effort. This is the effort that was apparently underway by a Fox News analyst upon the instruction of the president of the Fox Network, Roger Ailes, to try to convince General Petraeus to run for president. So apparently in the spring of 2011, when General Petraeus was still at his military posting in Afghanistan, Kathleen McFarland, a Fox News national security analyst, former national security aide, was sent over there, and Roger Ailes asked her to try to enlist Petraeus in the Republican presidential campaign. What in the world is going on? You know, is this really an appropriate role? Say it's an analyst who isn't supposedly an independent reporter. Notwithstanding that, it doesn't seem to me that that's at all an appropriate thing for a journalist to be doing.
Well, I love the fact that it's a story now. And the reason it's a story, of course, is that Petraeus has had his problems recently. I did a great deal to honor people in the past who were heroes at the time, but who turned out to have problems, like Scott Ritter. We gave him an award here at WMC as the Man of Courage of the Year. And every once in a while, somebody will write and say, you know, what would you think of Chartok? He honored Scott Ritter. Well, Scott Ritter at the time did the right thing. He said there were no weapons of mass destruction. He was a UN weapons inspector when we were being lied to as a country. And I think it took a lot of courage, former Marine and Republican, to do that. Well, so he has this problem later on, and I fully understand that if you say something good about somebody and it turns out that they weren't so good, for example, Bernie Kerik, Giuliani's top guy, and may cost Giuliani any chance at further political office, who turned out to be a rogue cop.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Ailes is acting like Hearst in the old days.
Yeah.
100 years
ago. Well, this is nothing
new. Empire building.
I mean.
And also, it's kind of interesting because the story was broken by Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. He's also no friend of the Obama administration either. It's all like these, I don't know. It's just.
Well, you wonder if President Obama got wind of it and if that is why he gave Petraeus the CIA job, you know, take him out of the field. Petraeus accepted shortly thereafter instead job of head of the CIA and went off to Washington.
Okay, that's a real conspiracy.
It is. I'll take Obama at his word. Obama said they didn't tell him.
I enjoyed Petraeus' reason for not running for president. My wife would divorce me, he said, and I love my wife.
What, you think you can't love somebody and love
and
somebody else
at
also?
The same time. Well,
darling, you can't order between
that sounds
two
like,
loves.
Is this media?
Darling,
oh, wait.
Darling, you can't love two and still stay true. The old folk song.
Oh, dear. What
or,
do you know?
Darling, you can't love three and still have me.
The conversation is devolving.
Is by the way, they've a little failure on the part of Fox. Rupert Murdoch has had to fold the Daily, the tablet magazine that he created, that never seemed to gain traction. It was
boring.
Why
did he have to fold it? He loses money on the Post. Why shouldn't he just lose money on that too?
Well, you have to decide where you're going to lose your money and what's worth keeping it. The Post at least gives him an influential podium in New York City. I don't think the Daily gave him anything.
And by the way, I have to tell you guys, for whatever it's worth, a lot of people are counting Rupert Murdoch out because he's old. That's a mistake because his mother died yesterday at 102.
Is that right?
Right.
102.
Yeah. So that gives Murdoch, you know, if that were the case.
Good
that
genes.
Was, yeah. 20 more years.
Well, that's quite something. So he's named a new editor of the Wall Street Journal, a guy who came from the BBC, the Financial Times, the Bank of England. Is there anything that we ought to say about the Briticization of American media thanks to Rupert Murdoch? Anglicization? No, never.
And it may not be ending. Apparently, he's in the market for the LA Times, I'm understanding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be quite something. More Murdoch control over things. So,
is it wrong of me?
Yes.
In the theater, when I go to the theater, and it's produced by Fox, because Roselle, who's sitting next to me, says, "Cut that out," and I go, when a fox comes.
Everybody else
is able to differentiate in their minds, you know, Fox Pictures and the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, you know. And yet, I think it's all part of this empire.
You know, my first summer in New York City, that came in New York City in the summer of 79 to start going to graduate school at Columbia Journalism School. And I went to a Park concert. In Central Park, they had the New York Philharmonic.
Sure.
And it was the last concert of the season. It was mid-August, and the guy got up on the stage and said, I'd like to thank the people who make this possible, the New York Council on the Arts, and people clapped, and the National Council on the Arts, and people clapped, and said, I'd like to thank Exxon Corporation. Everybody went, boo, boo, and the guy persisted. He said, no, now listen to me. If it weren't for Exxon, we wouldn't have these concerts. And everybody went, boo, boo. And I started to think about corporate support of the arts, and it actually led to my master's thesis, which was entitled The Pied Pipers of PBS, Corporate Manipulation of Public Television Programming.
And what did you conclude? That's interesting.
Well, at that time, Mobil was a major underwriter, and it was aiming PBS toward imported British dramas like Upstairs, Downstairs, rather than toward hard-hitting investigative journalism. It really did, I think, skew the programming on PBS, which had been created, remember, really to be a public affairs program for American consumers.
Fascinating.
Well, I get a lot of mail here about Monsanto. I think it's in our marketplace program, and they're underwriters. We don't do that. We haven't taken any of that, but you know, Monsanto, we take the program, the business program, and then our people call us up and say, hey, don't do that.
Well, why? You're not supposed to take the money from the people who were, if their money supports good programming, why not?
Because there's lots of reporting to be done about Monsanto. That's why.
Well,
you're not going to do it if you're taking their money.
I don't know. We take money from advertisers all the time and still do reporting about them, you know.
And you, Rex, of all people, know the difficulty of trying to report on advertisers.
Of course, it is difficult, but but you have to. You should be able to do it. I mean, speaking of which, you know, Alan has made a big deal out of the fact that there is no gun underwriting or no cigarette advertising on this station.
Right. Where's this going?
Well, Bob Costas, very interesting. NBC sportscaster Bob Costas did a commentary during halftime on a Sunday night NFL broadcast talking about gun control. And this is in the aftermath of the Kansas City Chiefs player who shot and killed his girlfriend and then killed himself afterwards in front of his coach. And the question that is raised is whether that was appropriate, I guess, for Bob Costas to do.
Conservative commentators just hate this, saying he has no right to talk about it. He has no particular expertise. He's just a sports commentator and therefore has no knowledge of gun rights. I think he was perfectly within his rights. And I was
courageous.
Courageous, even. And I wish he had gone further. He did not say anything about offensiveness. We're talking about subway photos. How offensive was it to have a Chiefs game right after this murder-suicide? Mm. That game was not canceled. NBC, who Bob Costa works for, broadcasted and made a lot of money off of the game. So it's also capitalizing on tragedy.
You know, well, add me to your side.
Wow,
I'm
great.
With you, Rosemary.
You know, it's not as though this is the first time Bob Costas has done commentary that deviates from straight sports commentary.
So he is.
He does a little bit of culture commentary as well. He's a guy who NBC pays to do commentary, and he issued a piece of commentary that was controversial. Power to him,
right.
I think.
You know? I agree, yeah.
Well, you know, and I've been criticized for opening my yap and giving an opinion here and there.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh.
And people say, you know, he shouldn't do that. Well, it depends on who's where you're sitting and what you believe the role of a journalist or public radio station or television station is. Apparently, we're doing well enough to make $1 million in every fund drive.
I suppose that's true.
The guns were connected to the sports. The guns and violence and sports.
Sure.
What else should he not be able to speak about? It just is crazy.
Well, yes, you know, I mean, you might, in fact, say that it would be good if he did a little commentary about, say, diet, which is another issue that is skewed by the sports.
How about head injuries in the NFL? Let's hear him talk about that, too.
Mm-hmm. Though I don't see NBC doing that,
right?
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. You know who's terrific, by the way, is Frank DeFord, whose commentaries are heard here on public radio. Former Sports Illustrated editor and editor of the National Sports Daily. And there is a guy whose sports commentary is fearless and insightful and frequently goes beyond just talking about what plays are going on in the field and really recognizes sports as being an important element of contemporary culture, and therefore he does cultural commentary when he talks about sports.
We talk about this in ethics class all the time. Do sportscasters or sports reporters have to abide by the same rules as ethical rules as news reporters? So, for example, if you're covering Tiger Woods, you only cover his game and his great stance and all the other things you can cover there, or do you also include his little problem with women? Why was that story not broken by sportscasters
and
OJ and go on and on? There's one story after another.
Yeah, well, and we here at WMCE Public Radio have a guy named Keith Strudler, who is the a weekly commentator on sports. He's the head of the communication department at Marist College, and he too is fearless. He's very good.
Yes, I know Keith. Mm-hmm.
He's very good, and he's a tenured member of the faculty, which is one of the reasons you have tenure to protect
tenure.
People.
You can say what you think.
Yeah. Protect people.
Fervently to be desired. What can you do? It says here, according to Gallup, the pollsters.
Sure, the ones who got it wrong in the election.
Just wanted to pause there to give you a little opportunity, Alan.
Okay,
you know,
sure.
I know you too well. That journalists get high ethics ratings from only 24% of Americans. When they're asked to rate the honesty and ethical standards of 22 common professions, journalists only get a 24% high rating.
I was stunned it was that high.
Yeah.
How does it compare?
Well, middle of the pack, I guess. Very high rating. The top is nurses and pharmacists, you know.
Sure.
And doctors and dentists. All the medical fields are right on the top because you entrust your life with them. You want to trust them. You want to believe it.
We
are. You don't want to believe the
journalists.
Truth.
Well, I've told this story once too many times, but there I am talking to a service group, you know, a Rotary-like group. I don't think it was a Rotary. And they're wondering why people are beating up on the journalists. And I say, well, how many of you in this room have had one story written about you, all movers and shakers? They all raise their hands. I said, put your hands down if you were satisfied that the story was completely true. No hands go down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why.
Yep.
It's hard to get it right. I mean, I think I've had the same experience. People, you know, details written around. But you know, below journalists would include governors, senators, members of Congress, HMO managers, stockbrokers, car salespeople. Lawyers, what do you say?
Well, but you know, it's a little like the legislative business. We hate all legislators, but we like our own. So here in New York State, I would point out that Governor Andrew Cuomo has a 72% approval rating right now. And yet people are willing to say we don't like governors and that we don't like legislators, but we like our legislators.
The one that hurts is bankers is above us. More people like confidence in bankers. The other problem with the media, of course, is that when there are problems, when there are ethical lapses, it becomes a big story. Jason Blair, we still know, and Janet Cook is a legend now for her errors. And there was a woman in Cape Cod who just was caught making up stories.
So interesting, because
years.
In that case, they issued a public apology
they
in
did.
The newspaper.
They did.
But then they went back and checked
they
out all her stories all of the years.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that for all of these years, she'd been doing it.
Yeah.
So
she just had these nice little touches in all her stories, you know, where things just sort of came together in a nice way, and they're almost all made up.
Oh, that's terrible. Where did she work?
A 59-year-old reporter for the Cape Cod Times.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
What do you know?
Yeah.
Was that James Reston's paper at one point?
No. That's James Reston's paper was on
Martha's Vineyard. Martha's Vineyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I almost became the editor of the Cape Cod Times many years ago.
Really? Aren't you lucky that you were?
Absolutely. I became the editor
of
the Times Union instead. Well, that was my wife's point. You know, salt water, the fish that you could eat.
Fresh lobster.
Finally, a little bit of good news for those of us who care about the future of institutional journalism. 37% of cell phone owners are using them to get news online. And as these pocket digital devices become ubiquitous, well, they are ubiquitous, but as they become more sophisticated, the notion is that you always have news with you.
Yeah.
And that's
or in the middle of the night.
Thing.
Mm-hmm. And when the New York Times is already on the stands with antiquated stuff, you get all the new stuff from the New York Times or the Times Union.
Right. So that's about the same percentage of people who use those devices to get turn-by-turn navigation. It's almost the same amount who use them to get to Facebook or some other social site.
And, ubiquitous, huh?
Ubiquitous. Isn't that good news?
Can you say that on the radio?
All right. Well, so WAMC's ubiquity will continue because we'll be back next week. We'll be all around us. Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok. True. I'm Rex Smith. You know, we're very grateful that you found the time to join us this week on the Media Project.
Reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh.